It's that time of the year. Your vacation is coming up. You can already hear the beach waves, feel the warm breeze, relax, and think about work. You really, really want it all to work out while you're away. Monday.com gives you and the team that peace of mind. When all work is on one platform and everyone's in sync, things just flow. Wherever you are, tap the banner to go to Monday.com.
So I'd like to brag that I am pretty sure that right now the weather in my great state of Minnesota is just so superior to whatever malarial swamp conditions you're all dealing with.
We're back to the weather again.
Damn right.
What is your weather like, Alan?
It's like 67, low humidity, blue skies, big fluffy clouds. You know, like the clouds that look like marshmallow fluff? We got the fluff clouds, and it makes me so happy.
Can I try a separate B-roll?
Wow, you guys really did fine. Y'all,
too much weather talk.
Screw you all. My weather B-roll was awesome. We can talk about how damp, how moist
we can't
it is.
We can't just talk about weather and use the word moist over and over again. That doesn't. Neither one of those is acceptable. It certainly does not qualify as B-roll.
We definitely can.
B-roll is hard. People don't appreciate B-roll's it. It's hard. It's hard to make casual conversation on demand. Usually you have a couple drinks first. You gotta
especially with people that you dislike so much. It's just awful.
And hello, everyone. Welcome back to Rational Security. I am one of your regular co-hosts, Scott R. Anderson. Thrilled to be back in the digital studio with my two other regular co-hosts, Alan Rosenstein.
Hello.
And Quinta Jurassic.
Hello.
We're thrilled to have back with us today, Lawfare's resident fellow in technology, policy, and law, Eugenia Lowstreet. Eugenia, thank you so much for joining us here again on Rational Security.
Thank you for having me.
We're looking forward to your object lesson. Past tradition says it is in the video game genre. I have no pressure. I am waiting here. I've got 1 week left of family leave, meaning it's the last bit of free time I'll get before I retire. Send it our way. But until then, we have a number of major national security news stories that have broken out in the headlines over the past week, which we are excited to talk over with you, including at least one that is quite up your alley. So without further ado, let us get to what we are calling the B-minus B-roll edition, in honor of some of our B-roll challenges we've been having in recent weeks.
We do the best we can, and it's often not very good.
Yeah, the idea that it's really B-roll, it's not really true. Sometimes it's just us trying to make conversation and then failing at making conversation. You know, it's the awkward coworker conversation, awkward coworker B-roll that we specialize in here. But regardless, let us get to the news stories of the week. Topic one for this week, digital solid parity. Which is exactly what this is, and you'll understand why in just a second. The Biden administration is making major moves when it comes to emerging technologies, with Secretary of State Anthony Blinken rolling out a new multilateral strategy for digital solidarity this week at the annual RSA Cybersecurity Conference, among other notable actions. What is new about what the Biden administration is doing, and where will it lead? Topic two, Avengers Endgame. Israeli military operations in Gaza may be entering a final stage, as forces may have begun an assault on Rafah, one that U.S. policymakers have warned against as it could harm the countless Gazan civilians that have sought refuge there. Will this be a breaking point for U.S. support for Israeli military operations, and how will it impact ongoing ceasefire negotiations? And topic three, stomp and circumstance. College campuses around the country are at a standstill due to student protests over U.S. support for the war in Gaza. Some universities have agreed to consider student demands, including divestment, while others have worked with local law enforcement to arrest protesters and disrupt encampments that they have set up. How should universities and the broader public be responding? What response should we see from President Biden, who recently addressed the situation in remarks he gave at Holocaust Remembrance Ceremony at the Holocaust Museum here in Washington, D.C.? With those topics in mind, Al, let me turn it over to you to get us started on our first one.
So let's talk about this new cyber strategy. I will admit, I'm always a little unsure how to respond to these big documents that come out of the government because they're pitched at such a high level. Though I did appreciate the pretty funny Ferris Bueller joke that Secretary Blinken made at the beginning of his RSA speech. As far as I can tell, the idea of digital solidarity, which is kind of the buzzword that runs throughout the State Department, new strategy, is that we should work with our allies, as we do in the economic domain and the political domain and the whatever domain, in the cyber domain as well. And not just cyber, but generally across lots of technologies. And so I guess my first question, I'm curious, Ehenia, what you think about this is, what if anything here is new? I mean, isn't the whole idea of having allies and ongoing diplomacies that we work with them on a lot of areas and haven't been working with them in cyber or other technical domains? What do you think?
Yes, the idea of digital solidarity and what that entails is not new, right? I mean, we've seen, I think the administration has been thinking about how to engage internationally on digital and cyber issues for a very long time. And in fact, the work spans from years before this administration came into power. If you look, for example, at the National Cybersecurity Strategy, which came out last year, it has an entire pillar dedicated to this. And, you know, thankfully and unsurprisingly, a lot of what's in this international strategy matches what was already in the National Cybersecurity Strategy. So there's nothing that I look at here that I'm like, oh my God, this is new. But I think that the articulation of digital solidarity as this affirmative vision of what the internet should look like is something different. I think we've seen hints at it coming from the way that different officials have been talking about how they position themselves and what they try to achieve in contrast to authoritarian states or backsliding democracies or what should not be happening. But I think this affirmative vision of this is what it should look like, this is what it means to have the free, open, interoperable, secure, resilient internet actually, you know, what it should be like. I think that's different. And I think it's a useful contribution, even if it's, you know, in this high level document, because it brings back so many of the different threats that we can see them acting on.
I think that's right. But I also think that there's like a different and potentially more, not problematic, but more kind of like less rose-colored glasses version of what digital solidarity means, right? Digital solidarity is part of a broader theme, I think, really, of how the Biden administration is thinking about pivoting the U.S. global posture across lots of domains. And this is kind of the digital iteration of it. And it borrows, I should notice, digital solidarity, a concept that it actually attributes to a Lawfare article written by contributor Pablo Chavez. So thank you, Pablo, for writing the piece. We're happy to have it see it cited in this national security strategy in the very first footnote, no less. And it's an interesting idea. Like, I think it's one that makes a lot of sense here. But what we've been seeing the Biden administration focus on across lots of domains is that we are going to work with our allies. That's a departure, and particularly economic domains. That's a departure, actually, from what was the U.S. orthodoxy throughout certainly the 1990s and really until, you know, 2015, 2016, which is the idea that we're going to promote a global economic order with kind of baseline rules for lots of different people. And the idea here, I think, is you could see it as an acceptance of or a move towards a world where you say, we just have fundamental different values than certain other global actors, and we're going to stop pretending like we're going to get past that easily. We're going to set rules that work for our group, meaning those people in our collection of states with certain values. We're going to collaborate and try and build a system that works for them, and then we're not going to try and we may be comfortable excluding states that don't buy into that value system. Maybe they will accept, you know, World Trade Organization standards or other low standards that, like, you know, China have worked towards for many years. But we're going to say, but we are having a higher standard that better reflects democratic values and other values. And it becomes both a basis for solidarity with similarly valued states or communities. But it also, as a double-edged sword, is a basis for excluding those that don't have those same values. I think you see that play here. In the digital realm, it kind of makes sense because speech is such a central value through so many digital activities. You know, I think if you were to boil this down, it essentially says, we're going to try and set up rules that facilitate speech and different types of activities in a safe manner, in a responsible manner, and that leaves it open, and that we're going to try and build a solidarity with states that have a similar value set that promotes free speech, but also in a responsible manner and not ripe to disinformation. And the clear suggestion of that, the implication of that, and I don't think it's particularly subtle in this document, is that states that don't buy into that value system aren't willing to play those rules, they may not be in this system. Does that sound right to you, Ehenia? Am I getting this wrong a little bit? I mean, I don't think they're saying those states are categorically excluded, but I think they are saying there's barriers to come into our community And if you don't meet those standards, then you might find yourself on the outside. And that is a different vision from a truly open global digital sphere.
So I'm going to offer a slight counter just based off how many of the lines of effort that are articulated in the strategy actually focus on using that alignment with the allies and partners to bring it, you know, in a common way to multilateral discussions where you may be faced with those that don't agree. Right. A lot of the effort also goes into, okay, how do we make sure that this vision actually manifests in, you know, the cybercrime negotiations, in standard setting, in, you know, the UN OEWG open-ended working group that is coming to a close, and in whatever the subsequent manifestation of that is. So I think while, yes, there is a focus on having that common understanding and advancing that, I don't think there is a relinquishing of, well, we're not going to come into the other spaces and try to advance this. I think that's something that the US had done a couple of years ago. It had kind of disappeared from some of the discussions. It ceded some terrain. And now I think they're trying to gain it back. So I don't think that they're necessarily giving back that space and saying, we're just going to splinter on our own little corner that is going to be free and open for those who want to play with us. I think they're trying to make sure that the global discussion doesn't go the way that Russia and China want it to go, basically.
I guess I'm curious for your thoughts about how that might play out in kind of edge cases is not exactly the right word. But like the other week, we were talking about India and sort of increasing authoritarianism there. At that point, that was in the context of transnational repression in terms of assassinations. But obviously, this is less dramatic, but still relevant in terms of, you know, data localization, other sort of measures to try to exert local control over the internet, limiting internet freedom, turning off the internet in Kashmir. I'm picking on India here because I think it's a good example, but I mean, you can extend these concerns to other countries that are sort of nominally within the circle of, you know, democratic allies and countries that share US values, but in practice have been acting otherwise. Do you have any sense of how this might play out in those cases?
So I don't know how it's going to play out, to be honest. But one of the concerns that I have with this articulation, one of the things that stands out to me is that overall, this, oh, we have the free, nice version of the internet that we sponsor, and then the authoritarian version that, you know, our adversaries sponsor, and we're going to try and get all the middle countries to go along with our vision. I think that's pretty black and white. And I do worry about how that's going to play out. I've talked to people who are part of those countries, and they don't see it in such stark terms. There's a lot of gray. There's a lot of, you know, concerns about maybe hypocrisy coming from the, well, we're the good guys. So if you go along with us, you know, this is the better version, and this is going to be better for you. And when I read things like, we're going to demonstrate the value of our approach, I just really wonder what that looks like and whether they're going to be taking the concerns and the positions from those countries that they're trying to bring into the fold seriously, or if this is just a, well, this is how we do it, and it's the better way, and you just better go along with it. So, and especially for cases like the ones that you mentioned, Quinta, where I think it also, it's not isolated. It's not a silo, right? You can't just say, well, this is how we're going to behave with you on digital policy and just ignore it, everything else. So I think there's just maybe too much there, especially when I think about India muddling the waters, for me to have a clear answer.
Yeah, I mean, the other question that comes to my mind is like how this, I don't know if you've noticed, but the US is forcing the divestment of TikTok, and how this fits into all of that. I mean, did that, like, has that come up at all? Because it seems kind of like a glaring inconsistency, let's say.
Well, I think, you know, if I were to guess, this would fall under the concern about how to build and maintain a resilient ecosystem that is built by providers that you can trust. And I think the question of trust is going to be doing a lot of heavy lifting. And how do you define that? And how do you convince others to trust who you trust and what that means? You know, I think the line from the administration is probably going to go along that route. It's just, it's a concern about who the provider is.
Yeah. And I mean, what I feel like that's very consistent, right, with what they're saying. I mean, they're standing in digital solidarity with the people they like and not with people they don't like. And, you know, this law is not about every foreign country. It's just about four foreign countries of concern. Now, you can criticize it, right, on other grounds if you want. But I mean, I don't know. This all seems to me to be about quite common sense. The obsession with the global internet has been, I think, honestly, pretty silly for the last at least 15 years or so. It's been very clear that a lot of sovereign countries don't want a global internet, and that's fine. This just seems like a extremely belated recognition of the reality that's on the ground.
Yeah, I mean, I think the TikTok case is a good demonstrator of the tension between the two edges of the sword and the sort of model, and the inclusiveness point that Eugenia made, which I think is a really key one that, frankly, American and Western audiences easily lose track of, which is that we see China as an implicit threat, frankly, more so than European and close allies do in many cases. Like, remember the struggle over, you know, implementing different types of telecommunications technology, like the Huawei debate of a few years ago, right? And how hard it was to get European countries on board with that standard, which bipartisan, you know, American policymakers were in more or less consensus on that. We didn't want this Huawei technology integrated into our telecommunications system. Like, there's just a spectrum of views about what is a valid and invalid actor. And so you are using universalizing language and aspirationally broad visions of how these systems work. Not universal, but broad. Like, you are accepting there's some limits, but I think the idea is that we're trying to build a system for all states that are like-minded, and many states see this as the better way to do it, democracies, et cetera, et cetera. Even among democracies, there are real differences of opinion. And so I think the real question then becomes, like, how much of this is about you compromising those security limits to promote more interoperability, and how much of it isn't? Here, like, the China case might be one where you're saying, okay, we can block China. That doesn't mean other countries can't interfere with TikTok. Maybe it doesn't bother us if other countries are still on TikTok. Although you can imagine situations where that actually would bother us because there's security conditions, right? Or, like, if it's telecommunications technology and we're saying major strategic allies, you can't buy into these telecommunications systems and be major strategic allies of ours. Well, then all of a sudden you are much more imposing your value system. And a lot of countries perceive what the United States and the West broadly, but particularly the United States, does much more as an imposition than Americans do across lots of domains. But this is certainly one of them, because what we see as clearly strategic logic doesn't account for their very different perspectives and different interests in many cases. And so it's a easy vision to dress up in very positive terms, but I think is reflecting a much more kind of realpolitik approach to this that implies conflict and dissent, and frankly, a degree of, like, power politics, probably in the end, in terms of how it actually operates, particularly around those sorts of more difficult issues.
I also want to push back a little bit, Alan, on this idea that, you know, this is just a recognition that the global internet is kind of a silly idea that is being left behind. When you listen to the speech at RSA from Secretary Blinken, he says, we're harnessing technology, and I'm reading straight from the transcript, we're harnessing technology for the betterment, not just of our people and our friends, but of all humanity. I think, you know, that might be rosy. I don't know how that's going to translate, but, you know, he's choosing, when he's presenting the strategy, to talk about all of humanity. That sounds pretty global to me.
I mean, I guess so. I mean, he's...
We Are the World plays in the background.
Yeah, like, look, that's State Department talk. And I'm not saying that that's bad, right? But, like, that's how the State Department talks. There's nothing wrong with that. And it's true, right, in that, you know, to the extent that the liberal world, I don't know how you want to define it, right? But to the extent that the good guys do better, I mean, I think that means the world does better, generally speaking. But, you know, at the end of the day, you know, when push comes to shove, you have to... It just sounds like he's accepting, and I'm all for it, right? That, you know, U.S. cyber policy cannot be held hostage by wanting to, you know, make China and Russia happy all the time.
I think the real question, the real push comes to shove moment of a framework like this is how aggressively and how objectively you police the entryway, right? Like, if you're setting up a system where you're saying, if these standards are met, you can come play in our yard, you can come play in our rule system, then what happens when you have a major strategic rival saying, oh, we think we meet this standard? And by the way, many of other countries in your orbit who want to do business with us, and there are plenty of countries who want to do business with China for cost differential reasons alone, right? Say, we think that they meet the standard, or at least we're satisfied with the standard that they have, right? And then it becomes, are you setting neutral standards, universalizable standards that can be extended to all these different contexts? That's what this document does suggest. And I think that might be honest, right? Like, because America differentiates itself from its major two strategic rivals in part based off of universalizable values that are very different from what those countries act upon, particularly around speech, right, and individual liberties. So, like, maybe you can draw that line, and you're never going to be forced to confront, are you really talking about universalized values, or are you really talking about much more parochial strategic interests that are much more nationalist-based or based in a national identity? But the tension's there. Right? Like I don't think you get away from that. And maybe that's okay. Like, maybe that's just the reality we're living in. But I think it's a much more complicated picture than it might look like, and a harder line to draw in terms of getting people on board. Because the one thing this really is clear on is that the United States, as in many other domains of the Biden administration, it's collecting allies, right? It's trying to build a network of supporters around these sorts of models, and that's the challenge. And if you fail at that, then none of this stuff succeeds. And so the question is, like, how successfully are you going to be able to navigate that task, I think?
Well, from a beautiful vision of international solidarity and cooperation to a very not beautiful and ugly situation. On Monday, Hamas made a surprising announcement that it had accepted Israel's ceasefire demands, which I think took everyone, perhaps most of all Israel, by surprise, and led to a pretty confusing few days in which there was a lot of back and forth about whether, you know, what specifically Hamas had agreed to, what the status of the ceasefire and hostage negotiations in Cairo were, what Israel's plans were in terms of the operation in Rafah, which has been looming for a few months now. As we're recording this on Wednesday, so Israel has announced that it's sending negotiators to Cairo to participate in these discussions, but also announced that the war cabinet had unanimously agreed to, and I quote, continue the operation in Rafah. That's from reporting from Barak Ravid, Axios, so I don't know how good the translation is, but there you have it. Meanwhile, the U.S. has reportedly paused bomb shipments to Israel out of concerns about what a operation in Rafah might look like. So there are a lot of different moving pieces here. Scott, just to start off, can you kind of give us an update about what the state of play is with the hostage and ceasefire negotiations and what the back and forth has been? Because I will confess, I was dizzied trying to figure out what is going on, what specifically Hamas's strategy was here, and also the extent to which, frankly, Netanyahu is the sticking point.
So it's a good question. I don't think we 100% know the answer to any of that yet. My understanding of the sequence here, although feel free if somebody who's been, if any of you have been tracking this to correct me, is that what we believe Hamas has accepted is an Egyptian and Qatari proposal who are acting as kind of the main interlocutors or mediators, where they put forward a proposal that they thought reasonably accommodated Israeli concerns and demands as kind of a step forward. And this is unusual. Like, this is how international negotiations go forward, right? Like, you often have a kind of mediator party who's putting forward different proposals saying, would you agree to this? Okay. I think this addresses your needs, other state. Can you agree to this? Okay, no, what are your outstanding needs? Let's go back and to have this kind of shuttle diplomacy, right? But having Hamas buy into this proposal is really notable because it already has kind of the Egyptian and Qatari weight behind it, because they, Egyptian and Qataris, in putting it forward, are essentially suggesting, well, we think this is a at least a reasonable position for Israeli to agree to. Israel has very clearly said they do not agree to it yet, but they're continuing to negotiate around it and are willing to continue to engage on it. The United States also hasn't endorsed the proposal either. It's not clear to what extent they were kind of involved at the front end. I'm not positive about this, but I would be really surprised if there's any direct involvement between Hamas and U.S. or Israeli negotiators. They're almost certainly working through the Egyptians and the Qataris. And so there's always this kind of game of telephone where things get kind of budged and you never know. And there's always a little bit of guessing about what's acceptable to other states. So it's still ironing through that. The timing is interesting. It came at a moment where we've been hearing about this Rafah operation for a while now. We know it's seemingly imminent. The Israeli government has said numerous times it's seemingly imminent. They're preparing for it. They're getting ready for it. It's getting closer and closer. We don't know exactly what it's going to look like. We saw the series of rocket attacks that might have provided an impetus for some Israeli military action. But whether that's the start of a broader movement towards Rafah or not, we don't know yet. They have shut down the border crossing. This is the southern border crossing into Gaza from Egypt, which is a major supply line. So humanitarian assistance has ceased coming into Gaza, at least as of the reporting I'm reading on this in the last few hours here on Wednesday on the East Coast. Israeli military operations of some sort have started, but notably senior administration officials being quoted in the media, primarily on Twitter so far, so this is like within the last hour or two or three, are saying, essentially, we are concerned and watching what the Israelis are doing, but this is not the operation we were concerned about, which I take to mean that the Americans, at least, do not think this is the Israelis starting a full-scale invasions, not quite a full scale military movement into Rafah that would require the mass relocation, which has been always been the concern about that sort of operation, because Rafah and areas in the south have become the last kind of safe zone for a lot of Gazan civilians. They are very much bottlenecked there, and the suspicion has been that for a lot of people who are very particularly skeptical and critical of the Israeli government is that they are trying to trigger a crisis that's going to force the Gazans to be able to take safe refuge outside of Gaza. And then they will be in Egypt, and then they're the Egyptians' problem, and they will not be let back into Gaza. Now, whether that's actually what the Israelis are intending or not, we don't know. I think the Israelis would be a little crazy to think they could easily get away with that without major repercussions, including for the relationship with the United States. But it's a possibility. Certainly, you've heard members of the Israeli government, including the governing coalition, say things that would align with that sort of approach, even though, frankly, the kind of mainline Israeli government statement has been, no, that's not what we're trying to do. We are trying to eliminate Hamas only. And that means we do have to like do operations in this territory, take control of the territory, eliminate underground bunkers and things like that. That will cause civilian damage, but we're not trying to permanently displace them. All this gets into this narrative about what is exactly Israeli planning, what is their end game scenario, and all those things that the Israeli government continues to be very cagey about. We don't have a clear plan about what they're planning to do other than take this territory, search for Hamas, eliminate Hamas. And then what comes next after that really isn't unclear. That includes like a real firm commitment that any Gazans that leave will be allowed back in, right? Like, and it's the lack of that firm commitment that is a contributor to this anxiety around this sort of case study. So right now we're on this moment where we see this operation might be kicking off, or at least some small version of it might be kicking off. And it's happening at a moment where the Biden administration has come out and been much more vocal than they've been. It's kind of been a slow build, but now we're at a point where they're openly criticizing the Israeli government and telling the Israeli government to their face in high-level meetings with senior officials, do not do this, or else this is going to be a major red line for us and is going to compromise our relationship. So what are the Israelis doing exactly? Like, is this an effort to take a half step that will still let them accomplish some strategic objectives, maybe satisfy domestic audience, political audiences, but without going so far in a way that burns the Biden administration, gives the Biden administration out and out to say, well, the Israelis aren't doing the thing we really didn't want them to do, and so we don't need to take this extra step we've kind of suggested we will take of cutting things off. At the same time, you see the United States, the Biden administration, actually doing real things, like small things, small steps, but they have put a halt on certain precision guidance munitions going to Israel. That's actually a major step psychologically, and a willingness to do that and accept the political consequences, I think. We've seen discussions about sanctions potentially being imposed on certain Israeli military units, certainly being seriously considered. There's a lot of chatter about ICC indictments of Netanyahu and other senior Israeli officials that have them very perturbed, I think for good reason, because Israelis like to travel outside of Israel, and you're like, you can't do that if you've been indicted by the ICC, maybe to the United States, maybe to Russia, not a lot of other places.
Yeah, you just go Tel Aviv to Miami and back and forth forever.
I mean, kind of, yeah.
I wasn't joking. That's literally what you do.
And it depends on what state you go to in the United States, because some of them have certain, you're not going to extradite it, but you might face some certain challenges on various legal fronts in the United States as well. So like, you know, you are in a difficult zone for the Israelis. They're really on the cusp of doing something that could be a big pivot point. The question is, are they walking a line that somehow they can still do what they've kind of promised domestic audiences they're going to do, which Smotrich and other people in their coalition say, we have to do. Like, I will leave the government if you back out of this military operation, which he did say in the last few days. Are they walking to find enough line where they can satisfy those audiences on either side? I'd be surprised if they can. But that seems to be maybe the line that they're beginning to walk down now.
I'm curious, Scott, how you see this in the context of not just Israel's relationship with the United States, but with other countries in the region. So I read I thought a very good, interesting Thomas Friedman column from like 2 weeks ago, where he was sort of saying Israel has two choices. It can sort of go into Rafah with all the problems that will entail, or it can instead join, you know, be recognized by Saudi Arabia, which apparently only requires like a verbal assurance of Palestinian statehood, and the Saudis clearly don't care. Be part of this even closer U.S. security agreement with, you know, the U.S. and Saudi and Israel. And I'm just sort of curious, you know, do you think that there's any possibility whether that sort of carrot or some other carrot would change Israel's decision whether to do the sort of full scale assault on Rafah?
You know, I don't know, because the Israeli decision making is a black box to some extent. We have a war cabinet that includes, opposition members and people who aren't part of this governing coalition. But Bibi is still the prime minister, is still calling a lot of the shots, is under a lot of pressure from his coalition. I don't think we really know what the calculus is or where we'll go. My strong suspicion is that, Bibi's government is constituted in substantial part on a coalition that includes lots of people that oppose doing anything short of, you know, completely fulfilling this military operation to the fullest possible extent and possibly doing more if some people might be serious about displacing Gazans or whatnot. That's part of the reason you're not seeing, I suspect, a lot of talk about what comes next, because nobody has a clear vision of what comes next that satisfies all parties. Because there are people who very openly associated with certain figures in the current coalition government saying we should reoccupy Gaza and make it another extension of Israel. You know, you see people advertising beachfront property superimposed over the images of the rubble in Gaza City, like really gross, disgusting things. But that is happening. And so, you know, I don't think we know. I don't think anyone knows. I don't think the Biden administration knows. Everybody's trying to ratchet these different pressures up. But the question is, how much of it is enough that it will steer either the broader Israeli voter base or political system to a different outcome? And my suspicion is that doesn't happen until you get a new government. And because of weird Israeli, not weird, understandable, but because of longstanding kind of Israeli political tradition, you're not getting a new government until the war's over. So you're stuck in this kind of catch-22 as to exactly where you get. That's about the best I can make sense of it. But other people who follow more closely may have a better idea.
Well, I'm sure that Netanyahu will do what's right for his country and his people and end the war quickly and resign so that Israel can move forward. So
something like
that. This problem should resolve itself shortly.
You know, I'd be kind of curious from your guys' perspective about where the political perspective is for people who are following the conflict, but maybe not as closely on the kind of tactical or diplomatic or strategic front. Where is the line about what the Biden administration can or can't do or should or shouldn't do in terms of pushing back to some extent? And how is that playing out? Because we're just seeing the domestic side of this is a major part of the calculus for all parties. But particularly in election year, I think is something the Biden administration has to take into account. And I'm curious about how you all feel about that.
I will say I don't have the polling in front of me right now, but I did see some polling about what Americans think about the war and then also to our next topic, the protests. And in unsurprising development to anyone who's paid attention to the views of the median voter, whose general opinions are, I wish bad things would not happen. They are against protests, but also against Israel's conduct in the war, which seems to me to put Biden in kind of an awkward position, because Americans are not crazy about what Israel has been doing. But also, you know, I think there's a hesitation on the administration's part to kind of break from what has long been American political orthodoxy, and sort of really break with Israel about this. I will say from my own perspective, I feel like I have become increasingly worried that the Biden administration is really fumbling this one. I mean, I've been worried about that for a while, but I'm even more worried now. At first, I think I was kind of holding out hope that the bear hug strategy of, you know, embracing Israel and maintaining leverage would work. And at this point, I don't know, man, you look at the photos of what Gaza looks like right now, and like maintaining your leverage to do what? Like the point at which you use that leverage has passed like 5 times. And I can understand, I suppose, just from a totally cold-blooded perspective, from a domestic politics perspective, why they don't want to take that leap. It does seem like Biden personally is very committed to maintaining a good relationship with Israel and to sort of Zionist, is a complicated word right now, but to, you know, the Zionist project in the original sense. But it's just hard for me to see the administration as anything other than an obstacle to me right now, which is depressing.
Yeah, so I will admit I'm skeptical that this matters that much in terms of domestic politics. If you think of domestic politics as sort of the macro swing states who will become president in 2024, it's just most Americans just don't think a lot about this, right? And to the extent, like Quinta said, the median voter doesn't like bad things. They don't like protests. They don't like Israel bombing Gaza. They really don't like Hamas, right? But you know, if you ask, you know, which side do they support, they generally support Israel over Hamas. Obviously, there are differences as you go down the age range, but sort of even among young
also,
Americans,
if you frame it as something other than Israel versus Hamas,
well, begins to get the mud air. That's true. That's true. But I think what's more important is like this is not in the top 10 of what Americans care about. And to preview a little bit our next topic, this isn't even in the top 10 of what American college students care about. And so, you know, I think that the political effect of this is not enormous. I think what is enormous is that the political elite class, the chattering classes, right, of which we are members, care enormously about this, just inherently. And therefore, this is occupying a massive amount of, you know, Biden and the administration's headspace. But I think it's because it's just this is an issue where American elites care enormously about Israel and about the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, but not because this is any sort of bread and butter issue that's going to motivate millions of Americans one way or the other.
So I think that's actually pretty wrong. Let me respond to that really quick.
I think your face is pretty wrong, Scott.
But
you respond to that.
I get the point. I mean, look, there's a point, like you can look at like what do people poll and what do they care about? And this doesn't make the list. It's totally true. And foreign policy almost never makes the list, right? But I think it really matters for optics around a presidency and how a presidency is perceived. Right? And this is an administration that is running off foreign policy. Like we heard the State of the Union. Foreign policy is the first third of the State of the Union. That is a huge part of Biden administration's pitch, particularly because of the kind of Bidenomics push that we heard a while ago.
I gotta say, if they're running on foreign policy, they are making an enormous mistake. Like in a world of sub-4 unemployment, and given that no one cares about foreign policy, that is political malpractice. It is an insane thing to run on foreign policy in 2024.
There's a reason they do it, because it's a point of contrast with former President Trump, a major point of contrast. And it is a vantage point that coming out of the Ukraine conflict, a lot of Americans really like what the Biden administration do and have issues with Republicans' approach to it, right? It was a good framing for them. And Gaza really complicates that, I think, in a really difficult way. And it's a hard line to draw. I don't sympathize with them trying to struggle, because you are really being pulled in a lot of different directions. And Gaza is really neat, because I actually think a lot of Americans really do care a lot about it. Is it a minority of Americans? Yeah. But they feel very, really clearly very strongly about it. The fact that you're having like public protests longstanding on every major American college campus is like an indicator of that. And they're not just college students who are engaged in this sort of public discourse, right? Rightly or wrongly, whether they agree with it or not. And perhaps most importantly, like that's political energy you would love to see channeled elsewhere, such as, you know, against another second Trump presidency. And you're not going to, even if it doesn't change how these people vote, maybe, and they don't really people you're worried about raising money from, they're the people who staff campaigns and run get out the vote efforts and whose energy and enthusiasm is like a big part of presidential campaigns. And I think actually losing that is a bit of a problem.
I had a question for you, Scott, and I'm sorry I'm taking us away from how do Americans think about this conflict.
You mean the only important question ever on any topic?
The damn
how
Yankees.
Dare you? How I dare know. You, Ania?
But, you know, as I was preparing for today's conversation, I was reading and, you know, it seems like in the last few days, Israeli authorities have either seized or closed two of the crossings. And I was wondering if you could maybe tell us a little bit more about like the impact of that on the ground. I saw some, I think it's a Human Rights Watch article where they were saying that this contravenes some of their obligations under ICJ orders. Is that so? You know, does this impact the calculus in the negotiations? You know, how long can they sustain having those crossings closed?
Yeah, it's a really good question. I mean, the big impact, as I understand it, from the border crossings closed is that those have become and kind of always have been the main conduit by humanitarian assistance is getting into Gaza, and Israelis taking control of them has meant not just they're taking control, it means that they're shutting them down. Like they're substantially reducing what can come through. I don't know if it's absolute zero or not, but their efforts to screen exactly what's coming through have become much more aggressive. And
are these the crossings that Hamas? My understanding is that Hamas fired rockets.
Hamas fired rockets at Kerem Shalom. Like
on the main Rafah cross, right? Or one of the main crossings. And that's what Israel took over, right?
So my understanding is that Hamas fired rockets at... So there's the Rafah crossing, which is between Gaza and Egypt. And then it's like a... like think of like a pyramid, right? Sort of on one leg of the pyramid is Rafah because there's Egypt right there. And then on the other... it's Kerem Shalom, which is between Israel and Gaza, and Hamas fired rockets at Kerem Shalom. I will say, having been to Kerem Shalom, like that is an incredibly complicated logistical operation, just like getting stuff through back and forth, that there is a lot of energy that is put into that, and winding that down or shutting it down or firing rockets at it, like is like a serious problem in terms of how much can get into Gaza.
Yes, although I don't think it's actually I think a lot of the flow through that has declined from when you or I I think we both have visited there before, a few years before the Gaza conflict. And like it used to be a major conduit where the Israelis would inspect so much coming through and a lot of commercial activity came through there and they would inspect a lot of it. And, you know, there are debates about how accurately they inspected things like that. But it certainly was a heavy flow through. And that's, I don't think has been the case recently. The question of like seizing control of the southern border, I think the Israelis have, I could be wrong. I think they've said it openly, like this in anticipation of an eventual military operation. So I don't think they're being shy about that. Like that's what they're doing. The question then remains like, what sort of military operation do we mean? There are under an obligation as a provisional measure from the ICJ to allow adequate humanitarian assistance in, and particularly to allow more in than they let in before. They said there was a basis for believing that this level of assistance had not been sufficient and Israel should be allowing that in. And they're under pressure from the United States and others to do that. The issue is that, you know, you can reconcile that with military necessity, like because the ICJ, and I think not improperly, like never said you can't pursue military action, Israel. So Israel will say, look, we shut this down for the next 2 weeks. We have to for the sake of our military operation because we don't want to have people coming in and out in an area that's subject to active hostilities. They have their rationale, and this has always been the tension. The Israelis have a legal rationale and argument about why what they're doing is consistent with international law. The problem is that most people don't agree with that because all the subjective judgment that is inherent in most of these operational calculuses and applications of international humanitarian law and other standards, like there's a lot of subjective judgment involved in that. And the Israelis can make certain assumptions or make certain assertions, and it seems to fit with international law under those assertions, but other people may say those aren't credible, they disagree with them, and you reach different outcomes. I suspect if this goes on very long, the one reality is this: if this lasts for a long time, ICJ will come back with them and say, what the heck's going on, guys? You need to open this up. And they risk aggravating the situation with the ICJ, which would be bad for them. I think the Israelis know that, even though they're willing to be confrontational with the ICJ. So it probably sets a time limit on how long the status quo can remain. But how much of a time limit, I think we're talking about a matter of like weeks or months, not you know, days. So Israel can shut this down for probably whatever time it needs to pursue whatever military operation it's going to pursue, is my suspicion, without risking anything majorly, unless it just drags on.
It's that time of the year. Your vacation is coming up. You can already hear the beach waves, feel the warm breeze, relax, and think about work. You really, really want it all to work out while you're away. Monday.com gives you and the team that peace of mind. When all work is on one platform and everyone's in sync, things just flow. Wherever you are, tap the banner to go to Monday.com.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
So we've already touched a bit on our third topic, so let us transition to that, and that is the home front question. This question about how the conflict in Gaza is coming back down to American campuses, because we've seen a pretty dramatic couple of weeks, couple of months in extent, but I think that's really come to a head in the past week or two. We've seen a number of major universities have been hosted major public demonstrations about U.S. support for Israel to various extent, with students in particular protesting and demanding usually divestment from Israel, to the extent that they have specific demands. Sometimes they don't really, but in several cases, having demanding divestment from Israel and or perhaps you know, major military contractors, other companies involved in the conflict by their universities. We've seen some universities say we're willing to talk about that and negotiate that. Brown did that, perhaps most notably in a negotiation that successfully actually closed down.
My alma mater, Wesleyan.
And Wesleyan, there you go.
As a Wesleyan graduate, I cannot stand by and allow it to be overshadowed by Brown.
That's what I was going to say. Wesleyan just did it because Brown did it. That was my suspicion.
We were first. Screw you.
Well, we'll see.
Oh my God. I got to say, no one cares about this particular rivalry. I cannot emphasize enough.
The state of Rhode Island is livid about it. On the one hand, on the other hand, you have other universities that have taken much more dramatic action in other directions. My alma mater, the University of Virginia, we've seen a fairly controversial police action by state police at the urging of university police and university administration, with people in riot gear essentially shutting down, arresting, and prosecuting a number of students and other people involved in an on-campus demonstration there. Columbia University, where I used to teach the last couple of years, instead of an affiliation, they've shut down their activities on campus for the year. Essentially, they're going completely online. They shut down their commencement ceremony. And this comes, of course, after efforts to disrupt demonstrations there coordinated with law enforcement and a refusal to cooperate with demands for divestment and other measures. It is a really tense moment in a way that I don't think we've seen in a long time, and at a scale we haven't seen in a long time. Over 2,000 people have been arrested in association with these demonstrations at different universities. I think in the last 2 weeks was a statistic I saw. And that's dramatic. That's a pretty substantial scale. And I'm curious about how we feel about the response to this and what it means both for the political scene domestically and perhaps the broader international dynamics that are related to the conflict, about the U.S.-Israeli relationship, U.S.-Palestinian relationship, and the tenor of the conflict. Alan, I know you are somebody who really pays attention and looks closely at speech on campuses. It's something you are a frequent Twitterer about, or whatever we call it, Xing. You're a quick frequent Xer. Tell us a little bit about your thoughts on this, and we'll see how other folks agree, disagree, or may feel otherwise.
I have many thoughts. I contain multitudes. I'm a Jew, so I have like three conflicting thoughts on each of these at all times. Obviously, I mean, so I think it's worth getting into this question of the police response, which has been controversial. Frankly, I think it's also worth getting into what, you know, the opposite approach, which is a lot of universities have really, I mean, I think capitulated is how I think about it to a lot of these demands, including my university, the University of Minnesota, in ways that I'm not necessarily thrilled about. We should get into the political implications, but I think it's worth taking a moment to, I think, explain why this is so uniquely unpleasant, Scott, as I think you sort of you pointed out. And I think this is because this is the first issue, certainly in my lifetime, or at least certainly in the last 20 years, where there's not clear consensus in these communities as to what the right answer is. I mean, obviously there were protests. I mean, it was complicated because it was COVID, but there were protests during, you know, after in the aftermath of George Floyd. But no one was, like, there was no counter-protest on behalf of Derek Chauvin. Like, there was no community that felt personally attacked by those protests. You can go back, maybe the Iraq War. I was a freshman in college in 2003. I don't remember any particularly sort of vituperative protests, though maybe I was wrong, but I think it's at least fair to say that in the last 20 years, this issue is unique because, again, there really is just disagreement on these campuses. The other problem, I think, is that universities have tried to do two things at once over the past 20 years. One thing they've tried to do is become giant hedge funds with, you know, a hospital center, a cancer research institute, a football team, and occasionally an English department. And that's fine. They're like allowed to do that. And this is the sort of neoliberal version of the university. And then simultaneously, they try to be social justice university, right? A lot of extremely elite universities brand themselves as places where you go, honestly, not even primarily to study. Like, that's just no longer, honestly, the brand of most elite universities, right? You'll study really hard and learn a lot of things. It's you'll come here and you'll have this really good, progressive, activist-y experience. And of course, some universities lean harder on this than others. But, you know, Columbia, for example, celebrates at this point the occupation of Hamilton Hall back in 1968. And the absurdity of taking these two visions and trying to glue them together, for me, was best evidenced actually a few weeks ago. One of the first universities to take a really hard line against the protesters was Vanderbilt. There was some scuffle, and I forget exactly the details, but that led Vanderbilt to actually expel a few of its students. And the day after, one of those students does a press conference. And I'll put my cards on the table. I am not particularly sympathetic to the politics of these protesters, but I was extremely sympathetic to one thing he said. He said, honestly, I'm a little confused. I'm paraphrasing here, obviously. I'm a little confused. I'm pretty sure that the reason that I was accepted to Vanderbilt was because for all of high school, and this was my entire college application, I was a LGBTQ activist in Ron DeSantis' Florida. And I'm pretty sure Vanderbilt really liked that about me. And then I come on campus, and this is what I get. Now, again, I'm someone who believes that neutral time, place, and manner restrictions are really important, that universities can't just change the rules because they have a particular view on the merits of a particular protest, and that in some cases, calling out the police is appropriate. But I'm extremely sympathetic to this kid's feeling of a bait and switch. And I think it's this real lack of clarity among our universities in the last 20 years of what exactly are they for? Because you just have to choose, right? And it's the lack of choice that has made these universities so unbelievably hypocritical and has made everyone, right, whether it's the Jewish pro-Israeli or at least not anti-Israeli student who spent 5 years hearing about DEI and microaggressions, but when people, you know, chant death to Israel, that's fine. You know, that student feels incredibly abandoned. And then on the other hand, the pro-Palestinian student, right, who went to campus and thought, wait, I thought we were all supposed to march after George Floyd and this and that, and now suddenly the cops are being called on. And so I think it's just a real failure of universities. And, you know, I have a lot more thoughts. We can talk about the police thing. I've thoughts about the kind of generational political implications of this, which I think are potentially extremely bad for Israel. You know, if you lose the youth, you've potentially lost the especially the elite youth, you've then lost a generation of policymakers, which is not so good. But I do think that is the core problem. And it puts these college presidents in an impossible position. Now, I don't have a ton of sympathy for these college presidents because they didn't enter that job making very clear what their view of the university was and what neutral principles they'd be able to or they would support. But I think that's fundamentally the problem. And the whole system is just completely unraveling.
I think it's difficult to figure out how to talk about this because there are so many different interlocking issues. Alan, as I think you set out really nicely, I mean, I think one of the issues does have to do with disagreement about what a university is, what I think neoliberal is an overused word, but I'm comfortable calling this the sort of development of the neoliberal university or the university as a product, or as someone pointed out on social media, and I can't remember who, I apologize because it was a great joke, that Columbia, in barring faculty and students from its buildings and making everything remote, had finally realized the dream of a university with no faculty and no students, but only administrators.
Yeah, there's a good Swiftian modest proposal in the Atlantic. Right, just fire all the faculty and students.
Right. See, the Institute for Advanced Study, they have the faculty, but they don't know the students, but they have the faculty. Columbia got rid of the faculty. I think that that is part of it. I think, frankly, as you say, Alan, I would address the kind of activist chic element of the universities draping themselves in this from a different angle, which is saying that it shows how ultimately aesthetic, shallow, and non-radical those policies ultimately were, and that they were aimed at selling, in true neoliberal style, a palatable product of activism rather than actually grappling with activism in its sometimes ugly manifestations. I think there is also an element in thinking about the role of the police here, and the shadow of Kent State, which looms extremely large over this, and for me, at least, was in part why I found so upsetting the decision to call in NYPD on college students, like the just sort of the image of outside police forces coming into a campus to respond to protests over a war is one that has a very particular history in the US context. I also think that there's a really complicated dynamic here in terms of what violence the police are willing to allow. So the New York Times has an investigation about essentially what happened at UCLA, where there was a camp of pro-Palestine protesters. There was a group of counter-protesters who showed up, which I would say pro-Israel, but I don't even think that's really right because at least one of them, I believe, was a neo-Nazi who basically just showed up to crack heads. Violent counter-protesters who attacked the protesters. The Times has video of this and essentially said that there is no evidence that any of the protesters, that counter-protesters attacked first, essentially. A lot of the protesters did nothing and were peaceful. Some of them fought back. And as far as I can tell, the cops basically just stood there and allowed this to happen. This is a pattern that we've seen repeatedly, and that then university administrators, I'm not quite sure if this happened at UCLA, but this has happened repeatedly, university administrators will look at that and say, these violence in these protests is just terrible. You saw this with President Shafiq at Columbia as well, where she's kind of has this little bit standing in one of the halls that NYPD broke into that the students were occupying, saying, look at this terrible destruction. And I think there's at least some documentation that a lot of that destruction was from NYPD rather than the students. So there's a lot, I think, to say here about the kind of aesthetics of violence and whose violence is acceptable, even in the domestic political context. The other thing that I will say and that I think is really important to keep track of here, and this cuts in both directions in terms of the politics of the protests, is that these are kids. I think people lose track of that. These are college students. Some of them are 18, some of them are 19, some of them in their early 20s. They are kids at school. And that means that a lot of them have poorly thought out views on things and do not know fully the history behind a lot of what they're doing. That doesn't mean that some of them don't. I'm sure a lot of them, you know, you can get a lot of cogent answers. But it also means that they're going to say dumb stuff, which is part of your God-given right as a college student. But it also means that a lot of the coverage, I think, has sort of been weird and invasive in ways that you would not otherwise accept for talking about teenagers. So just putting that on the table.
This is, I think, further proof that we can't go through an hour and a half without talking about TikTok a lot. last week, there was
Lord have mercy.
There was an interesting exchange at an event between Senator Romney and Secretary Blinken. I don't know if you've seen this, but they were talking about why the U.S. has been ineffective at communicating some of the justifications for Israel's role in Gaza. And Blinken responds that this is, you know, you have a social, and I'm just reading from his response, you have a social media ecosystem environment in which context, history, facts get lost, and the emotion, the impact of images dominates, right? And immediately after that, Senator Romney replies, you know, and some wonder why there's overwhelming support for us to shut down potentially TikTok. So a couple of questions about this, right? I mean, and again, this is not the entire exchange, but I think it's interesting. First, kind of the implication on both sides that, oh, the youths are being brainwashed by TikTok, right? Like, they don't really understand everything that's going on. And they're just like seeing short videos and now they're being brainwashed by, you know, the Chinese algorithm. And I'm, you know, putting words into their mouths here, but that's kind of how it reads to me. And then on the other side, this connection to, well, there's stuff on TikTok that doesn't align with what we would like people to be seeing. And so connecting the decision to maybe ban TikTok if it does not divest to the type of content that you can find on it seems to run counter to the national security argument that we've been hearing a lot about. So I'm really interested to hear your thoughts on that.
I love that Romney basically went out there and was like, we're aiming to do a content-based restriction.
No. Viewpoint-based. Even better. Even better. A viewpoint. Yeah.
And,
You're exactly right. The issue is not that there's a conflict between the stated rationale and national security. It's the national, you know, some senators clearly think that it's in the national security interest to not have these sorts of messages out there. And I get that as someone who, I think, you know, we've talked about this on the podcast, right, is ultimately in favor of the TikTok bill and will probably be writing a lot of things defending it through the litigation. Stuff like that does not make my life easier, right, when trying to defend on First Amendment grounds this thing. I think your broader question about brainwashing and all of that, let's put TikTok to a side. I don't think like TikTok is the reason why a bunch of college students are really pissed off at Israel. I think that Israel has, rightly or wrongly, but it's just a fact, has lost the war of ideas, the hearts and minds of a large percentage of America's youth. And to be clear, this isn't actually a Jew versus not Jew thing. If you look at how Jewish youth look at Israel, it's very similar to how non-Jews look at Israel, right? Do I think all of that is fair? No. I think that there's a lot of silliness and a lot of confusion. I think that, you know, the kind of unthinking idea that, you know, Jews are all white, especially in Israel, where it's ridiculous, right, given what, you know, the demographics, and that Jews are the European settler colonialist oppressor, is an insane statement, right, if you know anything about 20th century Jewish history or the last 3,000 years of Jewish history. And so if you want to say that, you know, college students have been brainwashed in that sense, okay, fine, to somewhat. But there's another way in which they've not been brainwashed, right? They have grown up, especially those who are 18. And there's I actually recommend folks listen to the latest Ezra Klein, which is a wonderful discussion with an Israeli journalist where they get into this, in which Israel has been a right-wing country led by Benjamin Netanyahu that has treated, you know, Gaza's complicated because of Hamas, but certainly has treated in the West Bank Palestinians really terribly. And there's just a lot less identification with Israel among American youth, including among American Jewish youth. Now, again, like you can complain about that, you can think that's good, you can think that's bad, but it's a fact. And I mention this because I think this is the important part of these protests, right? I mean, it's important because of what it'll do to American universities generally, and as like a law professor who lives in this world, I care a lot about that. But if we're thinking about the Israeli-Palestinian conflict and in general Israel, what is the most important issue the most important question is, you know, is this like a blip, and then, you know, a few years from now we'll forget all about this, and a lot of these protesters will look back and be kind of feel a little awkward about, you know, calling for intifada, global revolution, right? Or will this be the beginning of sort of a long movement that for a lot of people is the defining moment where they decided that, you know, if they had to choose between Israel and Palestine, or between Israel and their own, you know, personal ethics and values, they did not choose Israel. And that would be a disaster, an absolute disaster for Israel's security.
I will just say that, yeah, the idea that the kids are getting all this because of TikTok is extra funny when you think about, like, in the grand scheme of things of, like, student activism in the U.S. in the latter half of the 20th century, this is not, like, we have this, and then there's, like, Students for a Democratic Society, right? Like, the kids were bombing things in the 1970s. This is not that. So maybe I would suggest to Senator Romney to just take a few deep breaths.
Scott, I want to hear your views. I'm actually curious what you think.
I think it's a difficult question. I think I do boil down to the idea that I think public demonstration is a very valid means. I think there are very valid complaints people can express here. I don't think universities have to put limits on it. They should be neutral limits, as you noted. And I think civil disobedience may be appropriate and is okay and maybe a valorous thing to do sometimes, but civil disobedience means breaking the law, and it means you've got to get arrested sometimes. I had classmates who, like, loved to get arrested. They did it every weekend for a different cause when I was in college. I thought that was kind of silly myself. But, like,
it just did not surprise me that Order Muppet Scott Anderson did not join that.
No, you know, and, like, I mean, you know, I've done protests. I've done protesting at times. I've helped organize protests and done legal support for people protesting. So, like, you know, I think there's a lot of validity to it. But look, I think universities have a right also to set up an environment where they can keep doing their core function, which means they have to be able to have campuses where people can teach. They have to be able to have a place where students are safe and feel safe. That means having things like yelling genocidal comments or violent threats is bad. And I think that's a multi-way street. We got to remember, like, a lot of Palestinian and Muslim students and Arab students have come under a lot of really hateful things in the last few months, too. I think that actually gets lost in this, unfortunately, a lot, in a way that sometimes can leave a bitter taste in a lot of people's mouths, particularly members of those communities who face a lot of really, really horrific behavior, frankly, pretty regularly, separate and apart from October 7th, but certainly since October 7th. And we have to remember that as well. And universities and police forces should be involved in policing those standards. And they should be doing it equally. I do think this is a case where we're seeing a lot of focus on this because of the scale of legitimate concerns that have with Israeli conduct and U.S. support for it that have teed into this narrative that we've discussed before between the two sides, where you have people who are strongly pro-Israel, who have a worldview where they say, I don't think people can in good faith disagree with me or disagree with this. And the people who are strongly pro-Palestinian say, I don't think people who can in good faith disagree with me and disagree with this. And it leads to this alienation of the other side, where you're willing to embrace these heated rhetoric and these moments. And usually, yes, it's an isolated minority of people who are involved in those efforts. But I wish you saw opposition people, like people leading anti-Israeli policy demonstrations, say more frequently and say, like, Hamas did bad things. They're a terrorist group. They murder people. That's not appropriate. I wish people could say, who are pro-Israel, say, but they have to treat Palestinians properly. There's a lot more shades of gray between the positions that we don't really see evoked here. And that tendency for those more medium positions, I think, are the right ones or closer to the right one, to fall out of the speech, frankly, because of how heated and strongly held some of the more extreme viewpoints are, and then sometimes asserted, and yeah, sometimes asserted in violent ways by an unfortunate but very real few, like, really mutates the discourse around this. And campuses are, like, a touch point for this, because they are almost always, like, the tip of the spear for these sorts of broad sort of social movements. And I think, frankly, the Biden administration, the Democrats, deserve a little of heat for this, because I don't think they've done a good job channeling or anticipating discontent with U.S. policy on this in a way and addressing those concerns. And they need to do more towards that. And maybe they're moving in that direction, I hope, because I think there's very real discontent and not ill-founded or in bad faith there, even though some of it might be misplaced. So, you know, long and short of it, it's this vicious discourse that's not unfamiliar for people who've been following Israeli-Palestinian conflict for a long time. It's always been there. But this is just a moment where it's being brought to the fore and pulling in so many more people joining for other social, cultural, you know, reasons, joining in these demonstrations that have this kind of, like, youth culture moment, that it leads to an outcome that I don't think really serves any side properly, unfortunately, in this case. And I think your point about Israel losing the generation is a really good one. I mean, that's the takeaway from this. Like, whatever the current politics lead to, that's a big problem for Israel and people who support Israel and like Israel, even if they may disagree with aspects of their policies, right? Like, and that should be a real point of concern. I'm not sure how 100% you come back from that. But I think maybe if you have Israel move away from the trajectory of policies, particularly towards Palestinians, it's had for the last 20 or 30 years, and actually seem to move back in a direction that addresses concerns about Palestinian rights and treatment, maybe that helps. But that's not the trajectory we're really seeing at the moment. So yeah, I don't know. Those are my nascent thoughts. But we have no more time for nascent thoughts, unfortunately, here on Rational Security, because we have reached the end of our time.
No, no more time for thoughts, nascent or otherwise.
Nascent or otherwise. But this would not be Rational Security if we did not leave with some object lessons to ponder over in the week to come. Alan, what do you have for us this week?
So I have a new show that my wife and I are enjoying in the 20 minutes, again, that we have each night when our kids go to bed before we ourselves pass out. It's called Fellow Travelers. I think it's apparently based on a 2007 novel of the same name. It stars Matt Bomer and Jonathan Bailey, who are very handsome, I have to say, in this show, as two Washington, D.C. government folk that meet in the 1950s and fall in love, or at the very least sort of begin a romance. And it takes, you know, we're only a couple episodes in, but the series, I think, goes through the 50s and 60s and 70s and then sort of ends with the AIDS crisis in the 1980s. If those of you who have read, there's a wonderful book about, I forget what it was called a few years ago, called so like The Secret City or Gay Washington. I forget exactly what it was called, but it was like an amazing book about gay people in Washington, particularly in the 50s and during the so-called Lavender Scare. Yeah, it's like a fabulous show.
Secret City, I believe.
Secret City, that's what it was. Yeah, Secret City.
I think Shane actually interviewed the author on Chatter, if I recall.
Yeah, an amazing interview. But this is kind of like a romance novelized version of that. It's really good. It's really very moving. It's incredibly sad, honestly, just seeing what these people went through. I will say it's quite explicit. So if you're, you know, I would not watch it with the little ones. I think there was like a New York Times article a few days ago of, you know, sex is back on TV, and yes, it is. But it's an extremely good show. Yeah, it's a really cool look at this time. You get Roy Cohn is in there. It's the whole thing is excellent.
Well, you know, can't have a historical look back without Roy Cohn in there. That's what I'm looking for. Is exactly who's gonna bring that out.
There's a movie coming out about Trump and Roy Cohn. I think it's supposed to be at Cannes.
Really?
I imagine it's probably going to be terrible. I am kind of fascinated.
I am intrigued. Well, is that Quinta? What do you have for your object lesson this week? Is it Roy Cohn related?
It is not Roy Cohn. If only it were Roy Cohn related. I think there's a biography of him that came out the other year that I've actually been meaning to read. Well, I don't have any Bob Menendez updates for you listeners because that trial has not yet begun. But I did want to flag.
We have a new Democratic politician in trouble story.
Congratulations to Representative Henry Cuellar, Democrat of Texas, indicted by the Justice Department for alleged bribery by Azerbaijan, a twist, and an unnamed Mexican company, I believe. Cuellar's wife has also been indicted, making him, along with Menendez, the second Democratic wife guy to be indicted on corruption charges. Oh, we will see if his wife does better than Menendez's wife, who he is, given that Menendez is reportedly throwing his wife under the bus in his own trial. And my favorite part of this is actually Trump's response to it. Because Trump, you know, seemingly incapable of understanding, like, why Republicans are attacking Cuellar for this, is basically saying, like, oh, this is just the Biden Justice Department going after him. Because, you know, he looks at a guy indicted on corruption charges and he says, like, yeah, like, that's how you know, what's wrong with that? The whole thing is delightful. I'm so excited for this complete train crash. I will say that Cuellar did not face a Democratic primary opponent this round. Perhaps the party is regretting that. But we will see, and I will continue to provide updates.
Well, wonderful. Well, for my object lesson, I will step back from CD politics to share something I discovered in my childhood. Well, it's not really my childhood bedroom, but the bedroom where my parents moved all my crap from childhood that they still have because I'm at age 40, unable and unwilling to recover from their house.
My parents threw all that shit out. I'm impressed. My parents, that your parents
threatened to multiple times, and I'm literally clearing out my garage in hopes of receiving some more of it. My son and I, my three-year-old son, were poking through some of my old books, most of which are like college textbooks and a little beyond him, and we found a book that is so wonderful that we've spent like the last 4 days reading nonstop, and so great and so perfect both for like a parent and their kid. I have to share it. I don't know how widely read this was. Like, it was a big deal in my childhood, but maybe it's just I was the right moment. Because I'm not sure it's as big as it is, but it's Dinotopia. Do you all remember Dinotopia? Does this sound familiar to you all at all?
It sounds familiar, but I don't
remember. Feel like it had a hot moment, like when Alan, you're like, you and I are about the same age. I think you're like 2 years younger than I am. But like, yeah, when we were like little and then had a hot moment and then kind of faded. But it's this amazing book by this guy, James Gurney, who is a just absolutely phenomenal illustrator. He's actually like most well known other than Dinotopia for doing illustrations for National Geographic, where he reconstructs. This is what I loved about National Geographic. I subscribed for like 30 years for most of my early years, where you have these like amazing scenes where they reconstruct like historical empires and have these beautiful like visions of what the Byzantine temples look like and things like that. It's just phenomenal. He was the illustrator of a ton of those, and so he does these hyper realistic amazing watercolor sketches and whatnot. And he assembled this book, which is the fictional diary of a man who in 1860, a college professor and his son are shipwrecked on an island where dinosaurs have continued to exist and live alongside human beings in this like weird multicultural like civilization. But it's super interesting. It's super like deeply thought out, and it's this whole travelogue of him just traveling through this crazy continent and this whole world this guy has put together that features dinosaurs, which my three-year-old son loves. It features really complex world building and borrows from like tons of interesting ancient civilizations, which is stuff that I really enjoy. It's just visually stunning. And it's secretly kind of a long chapter book. So you can like read it for your kid and your kid will look at the pictures. You can read the text and then he'll fall asleep like in 2 pages, to the point that I think I have like a month's worth of bedtime story time getting out of this. So it's just phenomenal. So I am going to encourage you, go out and buy it. I don't even know if it's still in print. I suspect it is. But if not, go out and get those used copies and get the sequels, man, because I'm coming for them now. I don't know if I ever own the sequels, but I'm finding them. I'm loving this book. So Dinotopia, A Land Apart from Time by James Gurney. Check it out if you have a little one at home, or maybe even if you don't. It's still fun. Eugenia, bring us home. What do you have for us this week?
Okay, so it's going to be a video game.
Okay, thank yes. God. We were all nervous.
I know. I almost strayed into video game adjacent, but I'm going to stick to video games.
You would accept that. I would accept video game adjacent.
No, so this object lesson is tailored for the millennials who are kind of depressed, kind of anxious, kind of want to escape from, you know, the horrible news cycle that we live in. What I've gotten back into is The Sims. The Sims 4, nice. Which was, I think, my gateway originally into video gaming. But not only have I gotten into The Sims, I've gotten an expansion pack that is cottage living, where you can get chickens. You can get, yes.
This sounds amazing.
It is lovely. You have a little cottage. You have very cute outfits. And you're just raising chickens and planting, living off the land.
So you get to simulate being a retired person like 30 exactly. years before you're able to actually retire. Yes. That's almost cruel in a way.
So I don't know how familiar you are with this, but I think generationally, a lot of us millennials have adopted old person hobbies fairly early on. You know, we've gotten into like
in careers, working at think tanks, for example.
For example.
Complaining about college students.
Yes.
Complaining about
college students. The yeah. youth. I just think if you want to give that life a try, or just have a parallel life where you get to be in the sun all day, where, you know, not to sponsor any like Tradwife content, but if it's just a nice little escape from the day to day. So that's what I've been doing.
I love it. Yeah. I love it. That is basically the reality I'm living, of just trying to like plant my garden and take care of my children these past few weeks. So that's great.
There you go.
Scott makes a great Tradwife.
I'm a very good Tradwife. It's true. Well, with that endorsement, that brings us, unfortunately, to the end of this week's episode. But Rational Security is, of course, a production of Lawfare. So be sure to visit us at lawfaremedia.org for our show page with links to past episodes, for our written work and the written work of other Lawfare contributors, and for information on Lawfare's other phenomenal podcast series. While you're at it, be sure to follow us on Twitter or X at RATL Security, and be sure to leave a rating or review wherever you might be listening. Also, sign up to become a material supporter of Lawfare on Patreon for an ad-free version of this podcast and other special benefits. For more information, visit lawfaremedia.org/support. Our audio engineer and producer this week was Noam Osband of Goat Rodeo, and our music, as always, was performed by Sophia Yan, and we are once again edited by the wonderful Jen Pacha. On behalf of my co-hosts Alan and Quinta and our special guest Eugenio Lostri, I am Scott R. Anderson, and we will talk to you next week. Till then, goodbye!